I think we're supposed to speak about euthanasia, is that right? Euthanasia, yeah? I'd like to speak about the Jewish approach to the subject of end-of-life issues and euthanasia, and also to try to clarify the approach we have, or the principles that govern withholding therapy. In other words, under which situations are you allowed to, or perhaps even obliged to, stop therapy when somebody's desperately ill, or somebody's very ill or suffering, terminally ill? Under what circumstances can we withhold therapy? Let's. You're welcome to ask questions, but let me first try to lay out the picture as clearly as possible, and then whatever some specific interest to you, that we'll try to discuss. Who's a medical professional here? Okay, anyone here involved in terminal care or hospice treatment or anything like that? Okay, first of all, when we talk about euthanasia, we mean, the current definition of that term means basically, in one way or another, helping people die, right? Killing people, which in Israel, in Hebrew, they call hamatat chesed, which means mercy killing, kindness killing, right? Killing somebody because they are suffering. In the most sort of extreme form, you're talking about actually killing somebody because they're suffering. And this is the default position in Jewish law, is that that's completely forbidden. Not that we hold that it's completely immoral. That's not necessarily true. There are Torah sources that say that there are some circumstances in which a normal person might prefer death than very intense and protracted suffering. That is correct. It's not the right attitude, but it's a fully understandable human attitude. I remember some years ago in South Africa, it was a very agonizing situation in which was debated, and it was a case of a young man who happened to come across a car that was burning, and he saw there was someone in the car burning to death, and he could not get him out. He could only get close enough to shoot the fellow in the head. So he shot him, right? He shot him so that to kill him instantly, so he would not have to go through the agony of actually burning to death in his car in which he was trapped. And there was a lot of debate about that. Is that a moral thing to do? He certainly killed him out of a sense of morality. He was going to die a few minutes later anyway, and there would have been minutes of real agony, and so he figured that being shot in the head would be preferable for this individual, and it may well be that the individual who was thus dying could have agreed. It is possible. So we're not necessarily saying that it's not understandable or that it's intrinsically immoral. That needs discussion. But there's no question that from a Torah point of view, killing somebody because they're suffering is not allowed. So we can talk about the exceptions and how close to that we can get, but the default position has to be absolutely clear that we are not killing somebody, no matter how badly they're suffering. It's not within our permission, even if you argue that there may be some moral perspective you could bring to bear on this, and that the person themselves may choose to die summarily or instantly rather than suffer. Despite that, the Torah doesn't give us authority to kill. It does give us authority to give pain relief, even when the pain relief is risky, and we can talk about that. There's a lot to say here, but the default position has to be absolutely clear that we are not doing this. In a secular society, the values depend on what the democratic society votes. The current trend is moving rapidly, inexorably, towards a position where euthanasia is countenanced and practiced. In various ways. I'm not going to go here through a full review of the secular world's approach to this, but I'm sure you're aware that in many countries, over the last, Western countries, over the last 25 to 30 years, the law has moved more and more towards a position that accepts that the quality of life should be very much brought into play. In fact, there are many, many articles in medical literature now that discuss not only quality of life, but even cost. Right? The dilemma now is that we have mechanisms to keep people alive or keep them breathing for long periods of time, and these may be very expensive. And does society have to bear the expense of these sorts of modalities when the quality of life is, so to speak, not adequate? These are all dilemmas that face Western society, and the the movement has been very much towards the position in which we are putting at the forefront the question of quality of life and the question of things like expense, and therefore we will consider ending people's lives, or at least, at the very least, not prolonging people's lives. You know that the law in many countries now has got to a position where, in this country, for example, in Great Britain, and in the States, a number of courts have upheld the right of a person to refuse to be fed. Right? And in some cases, even the rights of parents to, or proxies, to say that a person who's terminally ill, or in some cases not even terminally ill, but very ill or in a persistent vegetative state, which is a state in which they may have no apparent consciousness, but they're not defined as terminally ill. A person in so-called PVS, persistent vegetative state, can live that way for years, right? Or in a state of coma. I personally know a young Jewish girl who's been comatized now for 35 years. She had a nose operation, a cosmetic procedure on her nose, when she was, I think, 20-ish or so, and she never recovered. She never woke up from the anesthetic. In those sorts of situations, the courts have ruled, famous cases in Missouri and various other places, have ruled that it's permissible to withhold therapy and even to withhold feeding, to switch off a ventilator and to withhold feeding. Judaism never approves of letting a person starve to death or dehydrate to death, and we'll try to discuss the details. But they're moving closer and closer to this position. There are also some moves in the modern world towards actively killing people. Examples you can think of are not only assisted suicide, where the courts have predominantly held against it. You know, the United States, there was a particularly famous individual who performed many cases of assisted suicide, and I think he was finally convicted of actually performing a euthanasia. In other words, not just helping someone die, but I think about 5 years ago he was convicted of actually on television killing somebody, right? Who was apparently very ill. He was convicted for that. In Australia in 1995, they passed a law in the Northern Territory allowing active euthanasia. That means with certain criteria in place, a person is terminally ill and repeats the desire to die, and they're not depressed, and more than one doctor proves it, all series of checks and balances, they allowed people to actually be killed. And a number of people died actually under that law during the time that it was in force. In Holland today, you may be aware that one of the leading causes of death, particularly among the elderly, is actual active euthanasia. The Dutch courts have, the Dutch system has actually come to a set of criteria where, although it's not strictly speaking legal, the courts have agreed not to prosecute. In other words, you can kill people under certain circumstances, and it's often practiced in Holland, and much research has been done. Actually killing people who are terminally ill or very elderly and very ill, even though it's not strictly speaking legal, and it's supposed to be reported, and there's supposed to be, again, certain checks and balances, and many. In one recently reviewed case that took place in Holland, where it was done, even there it was very clear that despite the very carefully laid out criteria, they were not fully complied with. So you're talking about a world situation where the secular trend, and it's a logical outcome of an evolutionary belief that we are actually biological organisms and our morality is not an absolute thing anyway. In a democratic system, we decide what's moral. That is all the current trend, and we have to speak very strongly against that because that's not the Jewish point of view. As I think I pointed out before, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch said very beautifully, in a democracy, the people make the law. In Torah, the law makes the people. Right? That's how we approach these things. So that's the position. What's the philosophical background? The Jewish philosophical background here primarily is because God doesn't give us authority to kill people no matter what their situation. The Torah has a prohibition of murder, and the fact that somebody's suffering is not a justification. There's no justification in the Torah for that. If you like, the understanding of this is that we consider life to be of infinite and value beyond any measure, and therefore to deprive a person of 1 second of life is something that is... that's objectionable in extreme. Perhaps just to mention a little bit of the feel for this, Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz has a famous presentation of the subject where he says that there are verses in the Torah that indicate that a person is alive. The concept, the idea of being alive is of such incredible value that no amount of suffering could possibly stack up against it. Now, again, don't make a mistake. That doesn't mean to say that a person who's suffering very badly might not well say, I'd rather be dead than go through the suffering. That is possible. But from an absolute perspective, somebody who understands what life is worth would certainly put life above suffering. One of the examples he quotes a few, one of the examples is where you see this classic illustration is that you see that there were three people. You know, the Midrash says there were three people who advised Pharaoh. When Pharaoh decided to try to kill the Jewish people or try to exterminate them, he took advice from three people: Bilam, Yisro, and Eov. Bilam, Jethro, and Job. And you know that Bilam said, yeah, kill them, destroy them. And his punishment was that he was killed by the Jewish people in the battle, you know, against his people. He's summarily executed. Yisro, Jethro, he avoided giving any advice, and he fled. Right? He fled rather than... He knew that if he said he was certainly a great moral individual, he would not say kill the Jewish people. But if he knew that he spoke positively, he'd be killed. So he fled. And Job prevaricated, right? He sat on the fence, and he didn't. He knew that he couldn't answer either answer, and he said nothing. The punishment for Bilam, who said kill the Jews, was he was executed. The punishment for Job was untold suffering. Untold suffering, right? The book of Job is a classic description of human suffering beyond all description, virtually. The question is, surely that's not balanced. The person who was very evil, Bilam, came to a quick and merciful end. Eov, who was much less negative than that, he just said nothing. He was punished with awful suffering. But you see that the Torah attitude here is that life with tremendous suffering is obviously worth much more than the end of life. That's what you see from this story. Another beautiful illustration of this is the fact that, and it's well known also, and he presents this, is that when Pharaoh met Jacob, when Yaakov Avinu came down to Egypt, and Pharaoh said to him, how old are you? How old are the years, how many are the days of the years ago? How old are you? And Jacob answered him, Yaakov said to him, my days have been few and not that many. In other words, he expressed the fact that he had suffered. After all, Yaakov suffered from the fact that his brother Esau tried to kill him and that Dinah was taken away by Shem. I mean, he went through, Joseph was taken away, so many sufferings he went through in his life that he said that he was a very, very old man at the time, and he answered Pharaoh's question about his age by saying that he had suffered greatly during his life. Now, the Midrash says a very interesting thing. That because he complained, because he said that his life had been difficult, for every word, listen to this amazing thing, for every word that he expressed, we're talking, of course, at his cosmic level. We're not talking about your level and mine. We're talking about somebody, one of the greatest people who ever lived at the level beyond all human measure. But nevertheless, at his level, he expressed some complaint about the fact that he had suffered. And for every word of complaint, he was punished with a year of his life being deducted. Right, the 33 words that are used there, he lived 33 years less than his father, than Yitzhak, because for every word of complaint about his life, a year of life was taken away. Okay, but it goes further than that. If you count up the words carefully, you'll find there were not 33 words. He spoke less words than that. To make up 33, you also have to include the words of Pharaoh's question. How old are you? How many are the days of the years of your life? If you add that sentence in, it comes to 33. Which incredibly means that a year of life was taken away from him from every word that he uttered, but he was also penalized with a year of life for every word that Pharaoh asked when he asked the question. What sense does that make? Says Reb Chaim, because Pharaoh asked the question, because when he looked at this elderly man, when he looked at Yaakov, he saw that he bore the weight of his suffering visibly. That means at his incredible level, you could tell that he'd suffered. At his level, listen to this amazing thing, at his level, the incredible value of life should have been so ecstatic, so elevated, so transcendent, that he shouldn't even have seen a vestige of suffering on him. The fact that you could see that he'd suffered meant that at his incredible level, he didn't value life enough, because anybody who values life enough knows that any amount of suffering pales into complete insignificance compared to the fact of being alive. Therefore, he should not even have looked old, and therefore Pharaoh shouldn't even have asked the question. So the fact that he bore on his face the kind of age that made this non-Jewish king ask him, how old are you? Even for those words, he was... And you're talking about, of course, an incredible level, but the message that comes through is, from a Jewish perspective, there's nothing, life is the most incredible, most precious thing that you could imagine, and therefore, we are not in the business of shortening life. On the contrary, we're in the business of lengthening life, of bringing people into the world. While we're on the subject, let's just mention a peculiar dilemma that the non-Jewish world has. You know, one of the dilemmas they have in the ethical zone is where a child, Le'aleinu, has a very serious illness, and they might be able to save the child if they have a sibling who has marrow, bone marrow that matches. The problem is, what happens if there's no sibling? This has happened quite commonly. A child is born, child has, let's say, a leukemia, something like that, and the child's life could be saved if only there were a sibling who antigenically matched. The problem is there's no sibling. So what do the parents do? They decide to conceive a child and bring a child into the world so they could use marrow from the child who's now born to save the life of the sibling. Okay? There's a big discussion about the morality of such a thing in the secular world. It's often been publicized and the news media have picked it up. Is it moral to bring a person into the world when the only purpose you're bringing them into the world for is to save the life of somebody? Yes? That means the parents don't want that child. The only reason they want their child is to save the life of a brother. Again, this is the parents who've completed their family, right? They now have a full family, 2 children and 1 puppy. Now, they've decided that that's enough, okay? That's more than enough. But one of the 2 children gets leukemia. So now, what is the morality of bringing another child into the world that you wouldn't have brought in otherwise so that you can save the life of the child with leukemia? It's been very hotly debated. And the general theme in the secular world is that it's highly questionable morally. To bring a child into the world for no purpose other than to save the life of another child, highly questionable. From a Jewish perspective, that's not questionable at all. From a Jewish perspective, we don't register the question. From a Jewish perspective, we don't need any reason to bring a child into the world. It's a big mitzvah. Is this clear? Again, if this is a family, say, with 13 children. To bring a 14th child into the world is incredible. What a fantastic mitzvah. Everybody should try to do that. Do you understand? If you can bring a child into the world, and as well as bringing this life into the world, save the life of a sister by using bone marrow, what? Even better. This just shows the difference in our approach and theirs. Their approach is that to bring someone into the world needs justification. The default position is don't bring someone into the world. You want to bring a child into the world? Show me justification. The Jewish position is you need justification not to bring a child into the world. It's a difficult world, full of fraught with pain and difficulty and suffering. But that's the Jewish position, is that life, no matter under which circumstances, correctly seen, is of such immeasurable value that it goes beyond description. Is this? Okay, and therefore, that's our philosophical approach. Now, what are the practical medical applications of this? So again, let's get it clear. Here's the hierarchy. First of all, somebody is suffering, and you might consider ending their life because they're suffering, or because they're not conscious and they'll never regain consciousness. We are not allowed to do that. Okay, is that clear? That's it. Now, what are the exceptions? How far can we go towards terminating the life of somebody who's suffering badly or who's terminally ill or can never regain consciousness, etc.? How far do we go? Well, there is a lot to say here. First of all, if you want, let me just give you one or two references. If you want to research the subject, and if you'd also like to make a review of the non-Jewish literature and approach to this to put it in context when you study the Jewish material, 2 very good references to start with are Professor Steinberg's Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics. Has a very nice section as a basic introduction to this. Also includes a number of references to non-Jewish books on medical ethics and journals that deal with these issues. And also the 3-volume Nishmat Avraham, which is Professor Avraham's compilation of all the issues in the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, that deal with medical ethics altogether, also has a very good section dealing particularly with brain death and switching of ventilators under those circumstances. It's a very good introduction with a lot of personal experience that he brings to the subject, having worked as a professor of medicine at Shaarei Tzedek and also been in touch with this generation's Torah leaders. He brings a lot of very personal references to bear on the subject. It's a good place to start. But let me try to summarize some of the issues. Hold your questions if you don't mind for a short while. Let me try to paint a picture, and then if I can, I'll try to answer questions. First of all, how far can we go to helping somebody die? Okay, how far can we go? There is one situation where we can do something that might allow somebody to die sooner. And that is what's called the situation of graces, which I'll try to explain, when something is hindering the person from dying. Let me try to explain. This is a famous Ramo that talks about it. And this Ramo is basically the source for this area. A graces is somebody in Jewish law who is, we don't really have a proper word for this in English, but it's more than terminal. It's a person who is terminally ill, and then they enter a phase, I think that probably the correct English word for this is agonal. Agonal means not just that they are terminally ill, but they're actually dying now. The signs of a graces are a person who is sort of gurgling, they cannot clear their secretions, they've got that sort of, in English they call it a death rattle. Anyone who's worked medically or worked with people who are dying or people in the Chevra Kedisha will know this picture. It's a person who's sort of breathing with difficulty or perhaps gasping. that can't clear the secretions in their respiratory tract, and it's a characteristic sort of an appearance. And the Gemara says that although not everybody who looks like that dies, but the vast majority of people who are in that category will die. In fact, the vast majority of people, the normal assumption is people in that circumstance die within 3 days. The norm is that a goysis does not last more than 72 hours. This is not an absolute rule. The Gemara itself and the sources make absolutely clear that there are cases like this that could even recover. There are people who might die in more than 3 days' time. But that is the norm, is that the majority of people who fit that diagnostic set of criteria, such people are deemed to be irreversibly dying, and within a day or two or three, the person will not, or perhaps even less than that, that person would not be alive. Now, in those circumstances, there are a number of unique laws. We haven't discussed this, I don't think, in detail. Let's try to clarify this. The unique laws of a goysis are, basically, the most important law here is you may not touch the person at all. Okay? You can't touch them. There are exceptions, but the general idea is you can't touch them. The reason is that the Gemara says that a person as a goysis is like a candle flame that is almost ready to be extinguished. If you've ever studied a candle flame carefully, I'm sure you've done that, right? All great Kabbalists study candle flames very carefully. Do you know that? Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yes. I know the ones of you who are saying no are just being modest, because I know you're famous Kabbalists in your own right. But there's a very important Kabbalistic exercise, meditational exercise, to study a candle flame. And if you're familiar with candle flames, you'll know that when the flame gets very, very low, it flickers when sometimes you can hardly tell whether it's there or not. It seems almost mysteriously to be somehow disconnected from the wick, connects again, disconnects. That is a situation where the slightest interference or movement can extinguish the light. A soul that is trying to leave the body in that situation is likened to that very, very final stage of a flame that's hardly attached to the wick. Any slight movement might extinguish it, and if you did that, you'd be guilty of spilling blood. Right? You'd be guilty of killing somebody. And for that reason, you may not move a goysis. Okay? Why would one wish to move a goysis? Well, of course, in the most extreme example, you might wish to move them because you actually define them as dead already and you start preparing them. Yeah, you close their eyes, you close their jaw, you start stopping up their apertures of their body. You might start dealing with them as a person who is being prepared for burial. That is absolutely forbidden in Jewish law, completely and utterly. First of all, it might cause the person suffering to know that you're already regarding him as dead, because a ghost can certainly be conscious. You're not allowed to do anything in Jewish law that makes a person feel hopeless, despairing, abandoned, about to die, even if you have to lie to them. Right? You're not allowed to say to somebody, the general default position is we don't tell a person who's desperately sick. You're not allowed to tell a person that someone in their family has died. Right? You're not allowed to tell them anything that might make them, that might burden their dangerous situation. Right? Even if they're not terminally ill, but they're just very sick. You may not tell them anything like that. Certainly do anything that indicates to them, okay, again, there are exceptions, of course, and times when you're obliged to. But you may not do anything that makes the person feel that they are hopeless, and for that reason alone, you'll not be allowed to touch them. But even if they weren't conscious, since any movement might extinguish the last flicker of life, you are not allowed to touch a goysis. Does this also include, for example, giving medication? What about giving intravenous medication? Somebody is in a hospital, they have, let's say, a drip in a vein, and you are wishing to continue a medicine or intravenous feeding or something like that with the case of a goysis. Many halachic authorities hold you're not allowed to do that either. Okay? Because giving something, although you don't move them, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says very clearly that giving something into a vein is a major, not movement, you understand, but effect on the person that could extinguish their life. You're not touching them physically, but you're touching them metabolically, so to speak. And therefore, you'd not be allowed to do this. Again, we're not talking about things that have a hope of saving the person that you're obliged to do. We're not talking about that. If there's any movement you could do, you could move their body. Or, certain basic nursing techniques, when they are thought to possibly prolong or be life-saving, could be allowed. Also, there's another exception, is you might be able to move a goysis ever so slightly and carefully to save another life. If, for example, you need to move the goysis to get somebody else into the intensive care, then Rosh Hashanah said you can move them under certain circumstances, certain provisos, that is possible. There are exceptions. But the general concept is to give a medicine that's not thought to be life-saving, or touch them or move them in a goysis is completely forbidden. Let me just note here that in practice, we find it very hard to diagnose this situation called gesisa. The reason is that we have lost the skill. Many poskim say that we no longer really know. When one famous doctor went to Rav Shlomo Zalman and said to him, "Can you tell me how we define a goyis?" He said to him, "You're the doctor. You're the doctor. You tell me." And the truth is that we have basically lost the art of knowing exactly where the skill is. Some say that people who work with the dying all the time know. People who work in the Chevra Kedisha, who are attending people who are dying, they are more familiar with these signs. We are tending to err on the side of assuming that the person might be saved, okay, because you have to be very careful, of course, because here you want to err on the side of assuming that the person could be saved. On the other hand, you do not want to err on the side of moving them and killing them. If they're regressive, see, we try to take on all aspects of stringency in the situation. However, that is a brief look at the idea of a goyis. Now, what happens if a person's dying and they're in the situation called gesisa and something is not allowing them to die? For example, someone's knocking on the wall. There's some building going on in the next room. Someone's hammering on the wall. This person is a goyis, and you see that as they sort of trying to die, as it were, the neshama is being brought back as if to say they're being startled back into when a person's trying to fall asleep. And a noise kind of wakes them each time. Right? That's an analogous situation. The person is trying to fall asleep. The neshama is trying to lift itself out of the body, but it keeps being brought back. They cannot die, as it were, because the noise keeps startling them back into awareness. That, the Kabbalists say, is very painful. That's a very painful stage when the soul is trying to separate from the body. And there's the famous Rama who says that you may stop the noise. Okay, you may stop the noise. Now, there's a whole discussion here about what you may do. There were certain mystical things that they used to do in the old days. For example, they used to put the keys of the shul under the pillow. Right? Yeah, with a certain mystical idea that would ease the departing of. There are all sorts of movements. There's a big discussion here about what you may and may not do. The conclusion is, the concept is, you may not do anything that actively causes the person to die. Anything, for example, that you would move them in any way, you couldn't do. But you may stop the noise. Is this clear? That's about as active as Jewish euthanasia gets. The person's dying, they're hopeless, they're terminal, they're regressive, there's no way they can be saved. You may not touch them, but a noise is keep startling them back into life. You may stop the noise. Okay? Now, don't get me wrong, that's not euthanasia. You didn't kill the person. But you removed something that's an impediment to their dying. Now, does this have specifically medical applications? Well, apart from this obvious example, there is one opinion. Rav Shlomo Zalman is famous for having said that in a person who's brain dead, he regards a person as brain dead as not dead. You know, we've discussed this question of brain death before, but as a probable gesisa situation. In other words, since the heart is beating and the ventilator is keeping the person breathing, then although the brainstem is not functioning, although certain aspects of the brain might be, such as the hypothalamus, there might be other brain functions which have not completely ceased, this is probably to be defined in Jewish law as a gesisa situation. If that's true, then you couldn't do anything to move them because you might extinguish their life. Says Rav Shlomo Zalman, you can switch off the ventilator. Why? Because the ventilator is only an impediment to their dying. Is this clear? Now, don't get this wrong. You cannot normally switch off a ventilator. A person who's ventilator dependent, you cannot switch that off. That's called killing them. But in a person who's brain dead, okay, that is possible to define. Again, there are many who disagree. Don't get carried away here. I'm just trying to give you a spread of opinions. There is at least one opinion that says that such a situation is very probably a goyis situation, and therefore the ventilator could be defined as only an impediment to the person dying, since he's not breathing on his own, and therefore you could switch off the ventilator. Now, one should definitely err on the side of not switching off the ventilator, because there are others who disagree. Let me give you an example. I once asked Rav Scheinberg about this. Rav Scheinberg says, although in theory that may be true, he would like to rule that one should not switch off the ventilator, and the reason is, who's to say that there's no respiratory effort at all? You see, the way brain death is diagnosed, as I've explained before, one of the central tests is an apnea test. You switch off the ventilator, and under certain very carefully controlled medical situation, for example, you have to be sure that the patient's not hypothermic, that they don't have certain drugs in their system that might explain why they're not breathing, and various other blood gas measurements. Under those circumstances, if all of that is correctly in place and the person does not breathe, that's an indication that the brainstem is not functioning, the breathing center in the brainstem is not functioning, and that's why the person is not breathing, and therefore they're not alive. That's one of the tests they do, which defines brainstem death. I didn't say that defines death in Jewish law, but it certainly defines brainstem dysfunction or non-function. If a person's in that situation, said Rav Scheinberg, if you're completely sure that in that situation, you may not be required to restart the ventilator. However, the concern is, who's to say that there isn't some incredibly light respiratory effort But the physiological stress of turning off the ventilator and doing the apnea test might extinguish that. Yes, we don't have tests that are so sensitive, and therefore, because of that fear, we try very hard not to switch off the ventilator until the heart stops, and then for some minutes after that, we don't interfere either. This is because there's a custom that when a person dies, when the heart stops and the breathing stops, we are waiting some time thereafter before diagnosing death. In the general custom in many communities is to wait for 20 minutes, in some communities for half an hour. No pues que me allow basically less than about a 5-minute wait, which is pretty much takes you into the zone where resuscitation would not be possible. Okay, once the heart has not been beating at all for 5 minutes with no circulation being maintained in any way, then you will not be able to resuscitate the person, provided they are normal. I'm not talking about a person who's very cold. Children have sometimes fallen into cold water and been at the bottom of a swimming pool for 4 hours and been completely successfully resuscitated, right? The reason is because the cold is metabolically arresting the damage to the highly metabolic cells that makes a person non-resuscitatable after that. But under normal circumstances where those are not the factors, then we are required to wait, and then the person would be diagnosed as dead. So those are the circumstances under which one we can discuss switching off ventilators. In that extreme opinion that holds that the ventilator is an impediment to dying in a correctly diagnosed brainstem dead person, there is an opinion that you can switch off the ventilator, or, according to Moshe Feinstein, when the ventilator is off anyway, because you are suctioning the patient or you're doing some, in fact, in the classic response that he wrote about this many years ago, he said you should wait until the oxygen is finished. You know, in those days, they used portable oxygen tanks, and the ventilator was run using or involving a finite supply of oxygen. When you disconnected the machine in order to reconnect a new oxygen bottle, he said, that was the time to assess your apnea, and if you were satisfied that the person wasn't alive, you wouldn't have to start the new oxygen bottle. Today we don't use, in most situations, portable oxygen supplies. We have a central oxygen gas supply that's packed centrally, and therefore you don't need ever to switch it off. However, so we do switch off the ventilator for purposes of tracheal toilet, suctioning the person and cleaning the connections and so forth, and that is a good opportunity to see whether there is apnea or not, and those who allow it would suggest that you are not required under those circumstances to start the machine again. However, the default position is we try not to switch off the ventilator, even in a situation as extreme as brain death. If you're not talking about brainstem death, you're talking about a person who's simply terminally ill, where the brainstem has not ceased functioning, then we definitely do not switch off the ventilator. Okay, is that clear? There are times when you're not required to put the person on the ventilator. We can try and talk about that. But once the person's off, we are not switching off the ventilator in those circumstances, except for the possible exception of a brainstem death scenario. Now, what have we learned? We've said that we don't actively terminate people's lives. We don't allow suicide. We don't assist in suicide. And the most extreme we can get is when a patient in a situation of gesisa, then possibly you can switch off the machine. That's debatable, preferable not. And if there's an external noise that's keeping the person, preventing them, as it were, from dying, then we are holding that you can stop that noise. Now, under what circumstances can you withhold therapy? Let's take the next step. Let's say a person's terminally ill. They don't want to continue with their therapy. Can you perform passive euthanasia in that sense? In other words, you're not killing them, but you are holding back something that would prolong their life. Under what circumstances can you do it? Let me try to make that plain, because that's absolutely central. And unfortunately, we are running into a lot of trouble nowadays where the secular world is not applying what Jewish law requires in these areas, as I mentioned before. So let's try to clarify as clearly as we can the Jewish criteria. There are circumstances where you are permitted to withhold therapy. But Moshe Feinstein writes very clearly that given the correct criteria, you're actually obliged to withhold therapy. Not just may withhold therapy, he holds you're obliged to withhold therapy. What are those circumstances? Well, let me try to describe them. First of all, you need somebody who's terminally ill. Okay? If the person's not terminally ill, then we don't talk about withholding therapy. If, for example, the person is, in a persistent vegetative state, or they've got a disease that may kill them ultimately, but not in the short term, that means, yeah, for example, they've got a gradually worsening dementia or Alzheimer's disease, or they've got amyotrophic lateral sclerosis where there's gradual degeneration of the motor neurons, and eventually they'll get to a situation of paralysis and inability to breathe. In all of these situations where we're not talking about a short-term terminal situation, then we do not withhold therapy. We're talking about a situation of what's known as terminally ill. Now, halakhically, that's defined pretty much as dying within a year. Okay, I'm not going to go now into the derivation for that. But a person who is expected under the with the consensus of best medical expertise opinions, that a person with that disease, at that stage of that disease, does not normally live for more than a year, that's what's halakhically called chayei sha'a. That means temporary life. What we would call in English, for purposes of this discussion, we'd call terminal. Again, there are other definitions for other purposes, but that is what we call terminally ill. Somebody who could live for more than a year, we call chayei olam, somebody who can live normally. So if you're dealing with somebody who's terminally ill, that means they would certainly die within a year. Secondly, who's suffering uncontrollably. And thirdly, who wants to die. Okay, let's get that clear again. Somebody's terminally ill, not somebody who's sort of long-term terminally ill, like all of us, you know, all of us, yeah. Life, you know, is a terminal situation, I'm afraid. But some of us just feel like we, you know, closer than others. But the point is that we're talking about somebody who's terminally ill, medically. Secondly, who is suffering uncontrollably. And thirdly, in view of all of that, they do not want to continue. Is that clear? Only in those circumstances may you withhold therapy. There is one other circumstance that Reb Chaim Oizer talks about, and that is a situation where a person's terminally ill. They're not suffering, but they're unconscious. They're unconscious in a way that they would never regain a moment's consciousness. That, he says, is equivalent to suffering. Is this clear? Not because it means the person's suffering, but because there they would be justified in not wanting to continue, because there's no value to their life in terms of development. That means there's no mitzvah. A person who's conscious for a moment, they may regain consciousness for one moment. In one moment, a person can do tshuva, right? They can have a thought that's incredibly meaningful. They can change their whole situation in the next world by a moment's repentance, for regret and repentance for what they've done. Even if they aren't able to speak out the vidui, the confession, it has a tremendous effect. It doesn't have the same effect as the mitzvah vidui. But even if they cannot speak, just a moment's sentient awareness of what my life has meant and what I regret is of infinite value. And therefore, a person who might have a moment's consciousness, this would not apply to. But somebody who would be terminally ill and could never regain consciousness, and under those circumstances would not want to continue, that would be justification for withholding therapy. Now, let's go through those criteria carefully. First of all, terminally ill, okay? Not sort of long-term, right? One of the first assisted suicides in America that was highly publicized by the same individual I mentioned before was a person who was a youngish middle-aged lady who had developed early signs of Alzheimer's disease. Early signs. She was still able to play tennis with her son when he helped her kill herself. Okay? That does not count. That does not count. You're not talking about a terminal, you're talking about a situation that is expected gradually to worsen over, you know, possibly over years. Okay? She decided she didn't want to get into that situation, so she had herself killed. Why not wait until she couldn't play tennis? No, she wanted to die now, okay? That is with her emotional stuff. You know, son should remember her beating him at tennis, and, you know, that's not, Jewishly, that's not the idea. We're talking about somebody, again, terminally ill, within a year of dying, inevitably dying. Secondly, suffering uncontrollably, okay? And in view of uncontrollable suffering, they want to die. Now, Jewishly, nobody should ever suffer uncontrollably. That is not, there's just no justification for that. Is this clear? Unfortunately, many terminally ill people do suffer terribly. The reason is because a few reasons. One is that traditionally, pain relief, especially pain relief for very sick people, has been very poorly taught in medical schools. It's very poorly taught for many reasons. One of the reasons is that it's a specialist area. Today, pain relief there are specialists in pain relief who know how to approach with very clever methodologies, sometimes not involving narcotic analgesics altogether, but certain kinds of nerve blocks. There are very clever techniques that can be used today to very effectively lessen suffering, and it's a specialist area, and it's only now beginning to gain acceptance, and it's been very poorly taught. There's another historical reason why pain relief has been inadequately done, and that is that there's always a fear. This is classically taught at medical school. That when you give adequate pain relief, for example, you give morphine to a person who's terminally ill, you may stop their breathing. In fact, it's well known that if you give enough morphine to a person who's sick enough, you will stop their breathing. So the fear has always been, look, the person's suffering, but if I relieve their suffering by giving them a major analgesic, I may stop them breathing, and they will upkill the person. And therefore, the tradition in medicine has always been to let them suffer rather more than relieve the suffering and you may kill them. And people have suffered terribly because the medical training has been to err on the side of giving too little pain relief, okay, rather than thing. There's another reason as well. There's always been a fear of major analgesia because of things like addiction. Now, addiction doesn't matter too much, you know, when you're about to die anyway, you know. But nevertheless, there's always been this kind of hesitation. Not only the addiction of the patient, but having major analgesics around that may be abused by people who could get their hands on them, and therefore there have been many medical situations where the morphine may not be given because it's locked away, and only under suitable circumstances with senior staff can it be used anyway. Today the trend is being much more liberalized, and today people are given, for example, morphine infusions where they can actually give themselves a shot of morphine or up their dose as they need to, rather than having to wait a very cruel 6 or 8 hours, whatever it is, till the next dose is given. Very often the next dose is given 8 hours later when the pain's actually gone. Right? And I've been in hospital where you see a disastrous situation where a patient has been struggling for 3 weeks to fall asleep. Finally they crash out and they fall asleep and the nurse shakes them and wakes them up to give them the sleeping pill. Okay, you know what you should do with a nurse like that. Okay. Anyway, that's what happens, right? So here's this person who's been screaming in agony for 6 or 8 hours. They finally manage to cope with the pain, and then they wake him up to give him their morphine, right? That does not make sense. And therefore, obviously, a much more liberal attitude is needed. Now, the question in Jewish law is, what is the reality of this problem of giving a person pain relief that may, in fact, suppress their respiration? How do we approach that? Let me mention briefly how this works. All the poskim are clear, all our authorities are clear, that you may give pain relief. In fact, you're obliged to, even if it's risky. Okay? Even if it's risky. Why? Let's try and analyze this clearly. The halachic problem here is as follows. Stay with me carefully. Here's a person who's desperately ill. They're suffering badly. Now, when you're giving them the pain relief, you are giving, let's assume you're giving them a risk of stopping their breathing or hastening their death, right? Why are you allowed to give a person a lethal risk? The clear situation where you can give a person, impose on a person a lethal risk, is because you want to prolong their life. If somebody, we've studied that before, if somebody's dying, and they're inevitably about to die, and you can offer them a therapy which is risky because if it fails it will kill them now, but if it succeeds it will save their life, that's clear you're allowed to take that risk. Is that clear? You can give somebody a risk, you can perform an operation on somebody where if it works they will live normally, but if it fails you'll kill them during the operation and deprive them of the 6 months they would have had to live. That's acceptable. And we've discussed that before when we discussed triage. The problem is, can you give somebody a risk like that where if it works, you're not going to save them, you're just going to relieve their pain? That's a completely different story. Here's a person who's suffering terribly. I want to give them a drug. Why? Because if the drug works, it will relieve their pain. If it fails, it will kill them. That doesn't stack up. You hear the problem. Says Rav Moshe Feinstein, in those circumstances, you're obliged to give the pain relief. Why? Because the pain is not innocuous. Pain is not just a symptom. It's also dangerous. Because a person is terminally ill and suffering desperately, the pain, the anguish, the despair, the hopelessness, the fear, all of those things are real lethal factors. So when you relieve a person's pain, or you relieve their depression or their anguish, you're not only being humane, you're actually treating the condition. Is this clear? Any good doctor knows that a person's emotional status and mental status is absolutely, definitely real, yeah, if not more than real, even critical sometimes in their situation. That's incidentally why for a person who's desperately ill, you can even do things that aren't directly life-saving on Shabbos. You can break Shabbos to do something for a person, okay, that isn't even directly life-saving because their life is generally in danger. That's how far we go. And therefore, there's no question that nobody should ever suffer uncontrollably. Even if you need to give such big doses of pain relief that you, with your own hands, you give them a measurable risk of dying, that is acceptable in Jewish law. Now, that has to be very carefully done. Let's not get carried away. Here are the conditions. Here are the conditions. The pain medicine must be given to relieve the pain, not to kill the patient. Not to kill the patient. That, if that's the attitude, not allowed to do it. Secondly, only the most experienced pair of hands may give that pain medicine. Do you know, I mentioned before that in the Code of Jewish Law is written that only the most competent doctor is allowed to treat a patient. No more junior person ever allowed to treat a patient with a more senior person available. Again, I think we went into the exceptions for that, right? There are exceptions. There are many exceptions. But the general principle is the patient gets the best in Jewish law. We don't allow a student to learn because he needs to know how to learn at the expense of the patient. The patient gets the best. Incidentally, that's what students need to learn as well. And therefore, the patient gets the best. So when pain medicine is being given to relieve pain, and a person is desperately and dangerously ill, it must first of all be given to relieve the pain, not to kill the patient. And secondly, the most experienced expert person has to be there to give it, titrating as carefully as possible the pain medicine against the pain, so that the person is given the maximum pain relief with the minimum risk of suppressing their breathing or causing them to die. Is that clear? When that's the case, then one is obliged to give the pain relief. And therefore, there should be no circumstance where somebody is suffering uncontrollably. So let's go back to our criteria. When may you withhold therapy? A, person terminally ill. B, suffering uncontrollably. That should not happen. Is this clear? But if it does happen, where a person is terminally ill, and they are suffering uncontrollably, and every effort has been made to relieve the suffering, and under those circumstances they do not want to continue, not because they're morbidly depressed or because they got some, you know, extraneous reason that could be psychiatrically treated or some relief given, but because cool, calm, collected under these circumstances, they're very clear that they do not want to continue, under those circumstances, you are obliged to withhold medical therapy. Now, this is very poorly applied. I'll give you an example. I have here a copy of the New England Journal of Medicine. I'll give you an example. About a month ago, an article appeared written by a psychiatrist who was on duty in a hospital. He got called to see a person who was ill. And this person had a very, what they call a low quality of life. He had been paralyzed on one side. He couldn't use half of his body. But his main problem was that he was very depressed. He was depressed because his wife had recently got a new hair color and a new man. Right? And she'd stopped coming to see him. And he was living in this hospital with basically nothing to live for, aware that his wife was, you know, taken up with some other man. And therefore, he had stopped eating. He had stopped eating. He refused to take his meals. He was starving himself to death in hospital. The liaison psychiatrist was called to testify, to give an opinion, a consult opinion about the man's mental status. In other words, if they felt that he was pathologically depressed, then they might not tolerate letting him starve himself to death. But if the psychiatrist would testify that he's a cool, calm, balanced mind, no psychiatric pathology, then since one of the highest values in modern medical ethics is patient autonomy, I do what I want, it's my life, they would allow him not to take his meals. The psychiatrist said he assessed the patient and he was bothered by one paradox. The man was not eating anything, but he was religiously taking his medicine. That's a peculiar psychiatric situation. He was taking all the medicine that he was given, religiously taking his medicine, okay, but he would not eat. So he said he didn't understand, it's a difficult psychiatric assessment. Why is he taking his medicine if he wants to die? On the other hand, he's not eating. Okay, he says he grappled with it, he was unable to come to a conclusion, but he authorized allowing the man to starve to death. Now, Jewishly, that is completely unacceptable. I would claim that it's even medically incompetent. Okay? I would suggest that it's also, under those circumstances, that patient, as any psychiatrist will tell you, is sending out a message. By taking his medicine, he's sending out a message. It may be a conflicted message, but he's sending out some sort of message. You don't just walk in on a one-time consultancy basis and authorize them to let the patient die. That is just not acceptable. In Jewish law, we never allow a person to starve themselves to death anyway. When we talk about withholding therapy, we're not talking about food. And I'll try to explain that. This is definitely not within our thing. There are many other applications. Here's an issue of the New England Journal that talks about the case of Sydney Miller. Let me tell you very briefly about the case of Sydney Miller. Sydney Miller was a girl, incidentally, which might be enough reason to not want to live, I suppose, if you've got a name like Sydney when you're a girl. But anyway, the point is that Sydney Miller was a baby born in the following circumstances. She was born in the United States a few years ago, and her problem was that she was born very premature. And during the pregnancy, it was apparent that she would be extremely premature. It was clear that she would that she was very small. The ultrasound showed at which stage her pregnancy was, and there was a reason that delivery became necessary. And the obstetrician and the neonatologist informed the parents that she had very little hope of being of surviving. They assessed her as being between 600 and 700 grams at that stage. Now that's very, very small, right? That's about the weight of 2 coffee cups full of coffee. Very, very small, right? Children under a kilogram are seriously compromised when they're born. She was extremely, extremely premature, and there was very little chance that she would survive. The parents said that under those circumstances, they did not want the child resuscitated. she'd be born. She almost certainly would not be able to breathe on her own. She'd need to be resuscitated, put in an incubator, etc. The parents said that given the chance that she would, such a small chance of surviving, and if she did survive, she had such severe impairments. She'd probably have brain hemorrhage, blindness, lung disease, mental retardation, etc. Therefore, the parents said, do not resuscitate, because the medical staff told them that they'd never had such a premature infant live, and would be pure guesswork at how they would manage. What happened, the doctors told them that although that was the assessment, they couldn't make a final analysis until they actually saw the baby, and the parents agreed to that, but they said they did not want the baby resuscitated. What happened was that the pediatrician in charge, when the child was born, decided to try to resuscitate it. He thought there was a hope, she was breathing on her own, and the baby was around 23 weeks, and they thought that it was worth resuscitating the baby. She weighed 615 grams, and she had a heartbeat, she gasped for air, she cried, and she looked normal. So what happened was, they intubated the baby and put on a ventilator. Unfortunately, a short time later, she had in fact had a brain hemorrhage, and she became severely disabled because of this. Now, a few years later, when the child was already a few years old, legally blind, she couldn't walk, she couldn't talk, she couldn't feed herself, she couldn't sit up, she had mental retardation, cerebral palsy, seizures, spastic quadriparesis in all her limbs. This is what happened to this baby. The parents sued the hospital. The parents sued the hospital for having saved their baby's life. Okay? Because they sued the hospital and its parent company for battery and negligence. They didn't sue the doctors because they thought that the doctors did what they were told by the hospital, but they sued the hospital for this case. The case came to trial in America, and the jury concluded that the hospital was grossly negligent, and the parent body of the hospital was grossly negligent, and they awarded for resuscitating this baby, Sydney, and the jury awarded the Miller family $29,400,000 for medical expenses, a further $17,503,000 in interest, and $13.5 million in punitive damages. Okay, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, reversed this verdict and gave the family nothing. Okay, the first court awarded the family how much is that? 29 plus 17. That's 47 here altogether. 60.5 million dollars. Okay, was the jury award to the family for this child's suffering and damage. The Court of Appeals reversed it and ordered that the Millers get nothing. Many people said after this case that they should have at least somehow been given enough to take care of their child's needs. Okay, in the end they were awarded nothing. 60 million is one thing, but enough money to cope for this child, eventually they were awarded nothing, which means that the problem here of paying for this child's needs. The point is that there are very difficult situations like this. Is that sort of suffering and that sort of, what would be the Jewish approach to resuscitation of a child like that, or a person who has that sort of suffering, that sort of prognosis, what would be the issue? There's very little discussion, I think, that in Jewish terms, when a child like that is born with a heartbeat, breathing and crying, etc., there's very little argument here that you wouldn't try your best to resuscitate such a baby, even though she was smaller than probably virtually any other child who had survived from that sort of weight. These are very, very difficult medical issues. However, where you can withhold therapy and not put a person like this on a ventilator, you would need, as I said, those criteria. Terminally ill, suffering uncontrollably, and under those circumstances would not want to continue. When it comes to a baby, Jewish law is that the parents... What happens when the person cannot say what they want? They're suffering terribly, terminally ill, but they cannot say what their wishes are. There we are accepting what they said in the past. Okay, you know that in America it's become very popular to have what's called a living will, where you say beforehand what you want later, and so on, all fraught with difficulty and problems and questions of whether the person actually still wants what they said they wanted when they were young. It's all a very difficult area. However, in Jewish law, where the person's opinion is relevant, for example here, right? This is a classic area where the patient's opinion is relevant. Not because we believe that patient autonomy is the highest value in Jewish law. That's not the point. But because there are circumstances where you do get to make a choice. If a person's terminal is suffering terribly, then they are given the choice about whether they want to continue or not. Here we will accept what the person said, even not at the time, if we are clear that this is what their wishes would have been. We are also clear, halachic authorities are also clear, that where the person never expressed what they want, but the family can testify what they would have wanted. Now we're talking here about a normal family, family that's interested in the best interest of the patient, not a family hovering around waiting for the inheritance. You know, we're not talking about that. We talk about normal people who are definitely acting in the best interest of the patient. There we will accept what the patient, what the family is telling us. And in the case of a child, all else being equal, there we will accept that the parents are fit to make a best decision for the child. Not where it contradicts Jewish law, but only where there is an option. There the parents would be considered the proxy to decide what would be best for the child. In those circumstances, we would withhold therapy. Now, be very careful. That means only withhold medical therapy. It does not mean withhold staple needs. Okay? You know the Catholic position on this, the Catholic position on this has taken a similar line. The Catholics rule that they make a distinction here with what they call ordinary and extraordinary therapy. Okay, whatever that means, I'm not exactly clear on how they define it. But in Jewish law, we're very clear that there is a distinction. The distinction is between that which is considered a medical intervention, like chemotherapy, surgery, that sort of thing, and that which is considered a staple need, like food, oxygen, liquid and electrolyte balance, insulin for a patient who is normally diabetic and needs the insulin, thyroid hormone for a person who takes thyroid, anything that was a staple basic need for that person that they would have needed anyway, you're forbidden to stop. Is this clear? We don't let people starve to death or dehydrate to death in a hospice because their life is, you know, terminal anyway. Okay, you are always required to continue with what the patients need. Now, it's debatable what kind of food a very sick and terminal patient needs. The food is very poorly absorbed and too much food could be harmful. That's an interesting technical medical debate. But whatever the metabolic need is, we are required to supply. So we would not do surgery or give chemotherapy in a situation like that. Okay? But, given the criteria that I mentioned before, but we would always ensure that the patient's getting adequate oxygen. I'm not talking here about putting a patient on a ventilator. There are circumstances where you don't need to put them on the ventilator. And of course it follows from this that you don't need to resuscitate them if they terminate. Okay, and I'll try and make that more clear. But under these circumstances, you would stop therapy, but you're obliged to continue with basic needs. The debatable categories are you also obliged to give blood and blood products? And are you obliged to give antibiotics in the case of infection? These are more debatable. Is blood and antibiotics, are those things considered medical therapy, or are those things considered staple needs? Now, there's room to debate this. The majority opinion in our post scheme seems to be that, and there's some who say it very clearly and explicitly, that things like blood are absolutely required and antibiotics for intercurrent infection are absolutely required. Since there's a debate about this, a Jewish doctor should always err on the side of trying to save a life. Do not err on the side of saying, let's not. And therefore, the general default position that you should have in your mind here is that we are always giving all the staples, including things like blood products, antibiotics and other things that would be considered a staple or basic need for that patient, as opposed to the definitive major therapy. Let's talk briefly about resuscitation. And again, all these things have to be filtered very carefully. You know, what does patient suffering mean? I was at a certain place in California some time ago, and I explained the criteria for withholding therapy and for letting people die. So one man in the audience put up his hand and he said, look, this is what happened to my late wife. He was remarried and his new wife was sitting there, and many people who knew him and his family. This is what happened. He said, my wife was comatose and she's terminally ill, and we went to see her in the hospice, and we were told there was no hope for her. She would never regain consciousness, and she was dying. So the nurse walked in and said to me, Would you consider, a question arose about whether she should be given a lethal dose of morphine, right? So he said that I said to the nurse, I think that's the right thing to do. So the nurse said to me, look, we don't do that here, and I'm not going to do that. So the other nurse said to her, look, why don't you leave the room? So the nurse left the room, and the nurse who had agreed gave his wife a lethal dose of morphine, and they sat next to her, and within 4 or 5 minutes, she stopped breathing, she died. So I said to him, he described the situation, and there was silence in the room. So I said to him, it was a very unpleasant situation. I mean, he had just admitted that this is what they had done to his wife. So on the one hand, I don't want to be upset a person like this, but on the other hand, you have to say what's correct. So I said to him, why did you decide to terminate her life? So he said, because she was suffering. So I said to him, but you said she was unconscious. So there was a long silence. So I said to him, you mean you were suffering? So he said, yes. So what happened here was this family killed their mother because the family was suffering very badly. Okay? Now, that's not the suffering we mean. Okay? That may be difficult. And suffering is, sometimes the suffering is extreme, and not only is the suffering, sometimes very expensive. Part of the family suffering is that family resources are being absorbed at a terrific rate. This person is a very expensive facility. Family is suffering watching them, and money is being expended that's really hopelessly spent. There can be very, very trying circumstances, okay? But to kill somebody by giving them an overdose of a drug deliberately intended to kill them, that is not what we are doing. You know, the famous case that began this whole debate was, already as many years ago now, was a famous, I'm not going to mention names, but a famous case of a young American resident who was on duty in hospital at night, and he wrote of an experience in the New England Journal of Medicine. He wrote that he was called late at night to a patient who was called Debbie. In fact, the article was called "It's All Over Now, Debbie," a famous landmark article that appeared. He was called to this patient's room, and she was a young girl with ovarian cancer. He walked into the room and he saw her lying, looking like she was in pain and looking very sick, and an older woman who was holding her hand and talking to her, and presumably her mother, but he didn't know. And he looked at the notes and saw that this girl was diagnosed as having inoperable terminal ovarian cancer. And the nurse asked him, you know, what he should do. And he, after thinking about it, he ordered enough morphine to kill her, basically. And he gave her this dose of morphine, and he said that she died very peacefully with a beautiful expression on her face while this woman sat there and stroked her hand and so on and so on. Now, he wrote this anonymously because that's murder. The time when he did it, okay, when he did this in American context, that was clearly defined as homicide. So he didn't, yeah. Of course, what happened later was those sorts of things became recognized, and in fact, he became a famous, and he's today a well-known voice in this debate on the side of, you know, killing people when they are suffering. Now, what many people objected to in that circumstance was, this was a doctor who came on this patient for the first time. He didn't even know her. He walked into the room in the middle of the night. She was not his patient. He never even spoke to our own doctors. All he did was look at notes in a chart, okay, and on the basis of his decision and his assessment of the situation, actually decide to terminate a young girl's life. I mean, that is absolutely beyond description. We're not talking about somebody close to the girl and a family who'd watched the whole situation, knew it intimately, knew it personally, knew what she was feeling. He hardly exchanged a word with the girl, okay, and felt that he was doing something very glorious and humanitarian. That may be the way the general world thinks about these things, but it is not. Many right-thinking people, even not religious at all, would seriously disagree with that. And of course, I'm not doing this. And you know that, as I've said, there are many movements that do this. There's a group called the Hemlock Society. Do you know about this? They published a book called Final Exit, with very clear instructions in how to kill yourself when you think you've had enough. Okay? Very popular book, of course, bestseller in America. And one of the problems with this book, of course, is that not only does it describe how to kill yourself, but the fear is that it is being used by many young people committing suicide. It gives you special instructions how to do this, where the person is not at all terminally ill or doesn't have any of the justification for withholding therapy. So in summary, our criteria for withholding therapy are, as I said before, terminally ill, suffering uncontrollably, under those circumstances does not want to continue, and even then we are not talking about stopping any basic or staple need. Equivalent situation might be somebody who's terminally ill and unconscious and would never regain a moment of consciousness, and under those circumstances would not want to terminate, would not want to continue. Even when a person fulfills the criteria, our authorities say that you should try to persuade them not to end it, not to withhold the therapy. You should go to the person and say to them, do you understand what a moment of life is worth and how incredibly valuable a moment of life is, and that it has infinite value? You should try to get them not to want to stop their therapy, but if they do, then one is free to do so. Let me just say one word about resuscitation, and then I'll stop and see, try to deal with the questions. You know that one of the big issues today in this whole field is when somebody does die, and there's a question of resuscitating them. Can you get their heart beating again and bring them back to having a viable circulation, heartbeat, breathing, etc.? What are the criteria for resuscitation? I'm not going to go into, I think we previously discussed exactly what the status of this move is. What are you doing when you resuscitate somebody? Are you resurrecting the dead, or are you saving a life? We discussed that, I think. That is a massive difference. If you're reviving the dead, that's another whole discussion. it's very questionable whether there's a mitzvah of reviving dead in the first place. And I think I mentioned things like, if the person was dead and you revived them, you know, does he have to remarry his wife because she's a widow? Does he have to beg his children for the inheritance that they just inherited because he just lost everything in the moment that he was dead? And all sorts of bizarre scenarios, like, as I pointed out, if during the 5 minutes that his heart had stopped beating, his wife was busy having an intimate liaison with someone else, that would actually be completely legal. I mean, it may be a little insensitive, but it would be completely illegal because she'd be a widow, even though 5 minutes later he was alive again. Okay? If, on the other hand, you say that in the 5 minutes that the heart has stopped, he's not dead, he's during the process of being resuscitated, then, of course, all that would not apply. And we went through those details. We basically rule that if a person can be resuscitated, he's not dead yet. And therefore, of course, we're talking about pikuach nefesh, which is saving a life, and therefore, of course, it's an obligation. So if somebody collapses and they could be revived, then you have a Torah obligation to revive them. Yeah, the obligation of not standing idly by while somebody dies. Because if they could be saved, you're obliged to save their life. Where may you not resuscitate? Where would it be acceptable not to resuscitate the person? I'll give you a very easy rule of thumb. In all the circumstances where you may withhold therapy, okay, then if the person dies, you must not resuscitate them. Again, here's somebody terminally ill. They're suffering terribly. They want to die, okay? You've made sure that they've got all their basic and staple needs. You're not giving them surgery or chemotherapy. And after a certain amount of time, they die. What are you doing jumping up and down on them trying to resuscitate them? You've just been getting to a situation where, right? In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, under those circumstances, you may pray for them to die. Again, normally we don't because we aren't sure that they're in a non-reversible situation, so it's better to pray that they should recover. But there are circumstances, and therefore, again, resuscitation is basically an obligation. That's the default position. But where you've reached a situation where you may withhold therapy, in fact, as I said, according to Moshe Feinstein, you'd be obliged to withhold therapy. Under those circumstances, if the person terminated, if their heart stopped beating, etc., then you would not be allowed to resuscitate them. What would be the point? But absent those factors, then you would try to resuscitate them, even if they have only a temporary life. For example, they're not suffering, or they want to continue. Person might want to live another month, right? Because they understand the incredible value of life. Many non-religious people choose to live another month or two or three so they can go to a child's wedding or a grandchild's bar mitzvah or some other pleasantly anticipated, event, right? So that is, of course, you would, under those circumstances, continue. One final word is, what about a person who is dying and you are not going to resuscitate them and you've withheld therapy and you know they're dying? How should you handle that situation? Basically, there are a few things to remember. One is that it's best for the person to say vidui, confession, right? To say confession of all their sins. A person is allowed to, and it's even a very good thing, to go through the full confession of all the Yom Kippur type of vidui. It's even better. There's a brief version which they can say, which is, you'll find it in any Siddur. The brief version is, Hashem, I'm in a desperately ill situation. It's my tefillah, my prayer to you that I should recover. Always hopeful, always positive. But if I should not, then may my death be an atonement. Because death is a tremendous power to atone for many problems and sins in a lifetime. And in view of that, I'm now going to confess whatever I've done, the mitzvah of vidui, which is the full speaking out of every aspect, but not to anyone else to hear, of course, with all the laws of tshuva that are attendant on this this occasion. It is a Jewish custom to do vidui before any major operation, before general anesthetic, and therefore a person doesn't have to be alarmed. If the person knows that this is the custom and they're going to a situation that's dangerous, they say the vidui. You should not impose this on somebody who's not aware of these things, because they might feel desperately hopeless. Here's a person who's kind of sort of sick. Suddenly the family starts gathering, you know? Everybody gathering. You know? People come from overseas. Everybody walks in kind of looking very somber. And then they say, you know, you ought to say, you know, it's like last rites. That is absolutely not enough to kill anybody. And therefore, you should not do that. It's only a person who's mentally adjusted. They're able to handle it. They know that it doesn't mean it's inevitably the end of their life. Person who's correctly prepared for this is a wonderful thing to do. People who are religiously trained, have a Jewish background, they understand these things. These are all very positive things to do. But it is thing. And finally, when the person's done this and you're there, there are various customs in different communities what to do when a person dies. It's preferable that they should say Shema if they can. the people who are present should not leave. It's very important not to leave a person alone. It's a very, very great comfort for the soul to be surrounded by people. A minyan, if present, actually, people shouldn't leave. Even if they've got other mitzvahs to do, they shouldn't leave. They should stay there, be present. Many communities have different customs of what they say. They say Shema. The proper thing to do is to say Shema. In the Gibraltar community, for example, the Chevra Kedisha has its own unique customs. They stay with the person. They say certain special things at the time. Each community has its own custom. Many people are saying the same, the way we end the Ilan Yom Kippur, right? Saying Hashem Hu Elokim, and you know, seven times. It's exactly like we do there. There are some unique customs about opening the windows and various other things. I'm not going to go into those things now, but these are the things to do at the time of think people not supposed to cry while the person's alive, not anything that might make them feel morbid. A person who can't control themselves has to leave the room because you sit there crying while the person's alive, right? Like mourning. In fact, people who are mourning for other people shouldn't even be present because the person might think that they, you know, in that sort of situation because they are desperately ill. These are all laws that are carefully worked out and all written. But that is the, and there are many other deals, of course, as well. Strictly speaking, the person who's there, when a Jew dies, you have to tear your clothes, right? You have to do kriya, even if it's not a relative of yours, because it's like seeing a Sefer Torah that's destroyed when a Jew dies. These are various of the laws that apply. But the main thing to emphasize here this evening really is much more the question of the Jewish attitude, which is that we do anything we can to save a life. That's the default position. We'll prolong life as much as possible. Our obligation is not to be executioners or to sort of pass sentence on people and say that they are hopeless. Our job is to do whatever we can. If there are any questions on these subjects, yeah, please.
Could you say then that a Jewish person who fits all three of your criteria should fill out an advanced directive to avoid...
Right, the question here is advanced directives. There's no obligation to fill an advanced directive. There's no problem filling it out, provided it complies with halachic criteria. For example, if you're in a situation where you think they may not apply the correct Jewish law, and you can fill out something that will make them take greater care, okay, what are you writing in your advanced directive? If you say, for example, I don't want to be resuscitated under certain circumstances, and those are the wrong circumstances, then in Jewish law that's not valid. And strictly speaking, we shouldn't obey that and honor that advance directive anyway. So the question is, what are you saying in your advance directive? Shaarei Tzedek Hospital has issued a card, a donor card, right? Like signing your driver's license. The card says, I hereby give permission for the following organs to be used from my own body if I die. You tick off which organs you want, and then there's a little block that says, under valid competent halachic guidance. That's fine. Because there you are stipulating, we are very concerned that if a person is in that sort of situation, they may do improper things. They may switch off the ventilator when you're not dead yet, halachically. We take all organs with the person. Therefore, we're concerned. In a country where you need to sign your driver's license, which gives blanket authority to do to you whatever the non-Jewish law is, you should definitely not sign your license. And in a country where they are thinking of changing the law, such as here, that every citizen will be deemed to have given permission, unless you sign to the contrary, then very fitting to have an advance directive, which is, I require that everything is done according to Jewish law. That's fine. Do not resuscitate orders are another whole problem, right? DNR, person signs on their form, and today the figure they quote in America is now about 40 to 50% of people coming into hospitals actually are filling out a, advance directives, DNRs, etc., as opposed to a much smaller percentage 10 years ago. The problem with the DNR is that when you say do not resuscitate, Jewishly, that's only valid where you wouldn't be obliged to resuscitate anyway. But there's a bigger concern. When a person says do not resuscitate, in circumstances where they are legally and halakhically permitted to say that, there's another concern. And that is that any doctor who works in a hospital will tell you, and I've been in a situation and connected with situations many times, when the staff see do not resuscitate, it's often read as do not treat. Again, what the person means is, if my life comes to an end in circumstances where it's not sensible to resuscitate me, don't resuscitate. But if something happens to me in the meantime that can be treated, treat me. Here's this person who's desperately ill, right? We expect them to die in 6 or 9 months. And they filled out DNR. Then they get an intercurrent infection. And if you put them in intensive care and treat them aggressively, they could be fine. Very often they're not admitted to intensive care. Because when the people see on the chart, do not resuscitate, they think this person doesn't want to live. And somehow, tacitly, what happens is they get less than the most aggressive therapy. All hospitals that have this constantly remind their staff, DNR does not mean do not treat. But unfortunately, there's a subliminal message here that often is acted on, which is they get less than optimal care. It's a very good reason for not having a DNR, even in situations where the resuscitation may in fact be acceptable not to engage. This is a complicated area. Yeah.
Process,
yeah.
Okay.
You
said you can't touch them, you can't actually at all
in principle,
kind of for them at all?
Yeah, the law of Gosis. No. The law of Gosis is you can't touch them in a way that, yeah, that means any movement, okay? Any movement or even any touch may be enough to extinguish their life.
But in a way that would be comforting to them?
So that's a good question. So there are point schemers say, let's say, sitting with that person and stroking their hand, making physical human contact with a person who's terrified. Because the ghost can be very conscious, okay? But you have to be very, very careful. Very, very careful. Touching them in a way that doesn't comfort them but kills them is not what we mean.
Right.
Okay, so there are circumstances where this could be.
And then also, if you said you can't say anything to them that might upset them,
yeah.
What is that asking you permission to be able to die?
Well, if what you're going to tell them is not going to upset them, that person is spiritually adjusted, okay? They're ready, they prepared themselves, they're on a high level of preparation and spiritual preparedness and so forth, right? Then that's okay, yeah? But I mean, you have to be careful not to do something that is going to give them a burden. Even in those circumstances, you should be positive. We always give a positive message. By the way, a terrible, terrible aspect of modern medicine is this absolutely brutal, blatant telling of the news. I was dealing with a lady in intensive care here in London 2 weeks ago. She unfortunately died last week. She was in intensive care for a long time, for 2 or 3 months. She was admitted suddenly with an acute abdominal emergency, and she had trouble breathing and put in intensive care. No one knew what the diagnosis was, okay? She'd been well until then. Her husband just died the week before. Shocked lady, traumatized, mourning, suddenly gets acute abdominal emergency, put into intensive care. While she's on this respirator, the gynecologist walks over, no previous warning, her family, son and daughter standing around the bed, walks over and says, "Lady, Mrs. Sansa, you got cancer, okay, this is incurable, and, like, you know, you just better accept the fact." I mean, that is absolutely inhuman. He didn't even discuss it with the family before. So the son said to him, daughter and son-in-law, they said, "Don't you think you should have discussed this?" He said, "No, the modern policy is to tell patients the news." You know, in Jewish law, that is completely and utterly forbidden. Even when you're obliged to tell bad news in Jewish law, you're not allowed to say it directly. Do you know that? When you have to tell somebody bad news, the way you have to tell them is in a way that allows them to work it out themselves. You have to sit there and say, like they say, "Look, how is my father?" And you say, "Well, he's not well." And then they say, "Do you mean..." And you have to let them gradually figure out what you mean. You're not allowed... It's a terrible shock. Terrible shock to person. It's enough to cause a tremendous burden to in their burden of illness. You're not allowed to do that. And the current story, the current custom, and what shall I say, the current
trend,
yeah, is that you tell news. You know, Frank, you tell it like it is, you know, etc. Now, sometimes you have to. A person who's got cancer needs chemotherapy. You can't tell them they've got a cold, you know, because, like, if they've got a bad cold, you're not going to give them chemotherapy. They need to cooperate. But there's a way to do it. At the same time you say they've got cancer, you have to tell them that many cancers are curable, and we've got much better figures than we had now, and many people, it's written halachically, you have to say to them, many people in your situation have survived, even if it's a minority, but many have. And statistics are not the whole story. No, you have to be very positive. There's a whole different, you can give a very, we're going to fight this together, and you know, and but to say, listen, it's incurable and terminal, and not, yeah, but it's a completely incomprehensible. That's not allowed. Yeah. That's a good question. How old do you have to be halachically to decide these things? The general answer is bar mitzvah, which means 13 for a boy, 12 for a girl. And it is very young. It's very young. But that's the technical minimal age. For many of these things, 20 is a more realistic age. In Jewish law, although you bar mitzvah at 12 and 13, you're only considered fully emotionally and spiritually mature at 20. For example, yeah, there are many, many. You're not, there's certain things that you're not punishable for spiritually until you're 20 years old. But irrespective of age, if you think the person's immature or emotionally unable to handle these things, then it doesn't matter what their age is. Okay? And therefore, the person is trying to make decisions about whether they want to continue, and you know it's due to a psychiatric burden, a depression, immaturity, etc., etc., right? or it's an elderly person who thinks they ought to die because they're a burden on their family. All these things are real today, okay? Then, of course, you have to err on the side of the positive and the life-saving. We'll stop here.